Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience podcast series. Each podcast will explore a different element of the fan experience and fan engagement. Some will look at the matchday experience, while others will explore broader themes. But every podcast will deliver value to anyone listening in football or indeed any other spectator sport. So whether it's general advice you need or ways to help you start a conversation with your own colleagues, we reckon that a regular dose of the fan experience will make a difference. So join me, Mark.
And me, Darren, as we explore ways of improving the experience on match days, making clubs more sustainable and relying less on winning to keep fans engaged.
And of course, if you want to find out more about us, the Fan Experience Company, and the work we do, please check out our website at www.fanexperienceco.com. Well, this time it's one of our specials. We've got someone, a senior person in the football industry, with a really interesting perspective on fan engagement and the fan experience. This is a friend of mine, someone I met back in 2008, 12 years ago now. He's been a player. He's worked in marketing. He's been a general manager at a national association. And he's currently head of business development for national associations at UEFA. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to Noel Mooney.
Hey, Mark. Thank you very much for the invite. I'm looking forward to the chat.
No, it's great to have you here. I mean, for people listening, a lot of people will know you, of course. But 1998, I read that you won the FAI Cup with Cork City as a goalkeeper. That's where the story starts, yeah?
Yeah, Cork City was like, to us, was like our Manchester United in the region of southwest Ireland. I grew up in Limerick, but Cork City was the cool club, I suppose. They played against Bayern Munich and Galatasaray in European competition the years before that. I started playing for Limerick, but Cork signed me when I was, I think, 18, and I managed to get the number one goalkeeping spot when I think it was 19. And we qualified to we qualified for Europe practically every year, which was great. So I got to play in UEFA club competitions, which is great. But in 98, we got to the FAI Cup final, and we got to play against a really good team called Shelburne, who were winning everything at the time. And thankfully, over two legs, because we drew the first 0-0, we won the replay 1-0. So I played in two cup finals and conceded no goals.
Two clean sheets, wow.
Clean sheets. It was great. It really was great. But I was still very young at that stage in 98. I was very early 20s. But in truth, I mean, won the League Cup that year as well against Shamrock Rovers. In truth, I had started to study marketing while I was a player, and I was interested in the business world as well. So I was reading marketing on my own at home. I was starting then to take some courses in the evening on marketing. And I suppose what I managed to do was to marry, or certainly there was a moment where I realized that if we married my love of football, which was as a player and as a fan, with the principles and processes of marketing, first of all, that that was perfect for me. So if I married marketing with football, that was heaven for me.
Well, that was interesting, because that kind of brings us to the point where we met, wasn't it? Because back in 2007, 2008, you'd been appointed to the FAI team, and you introduced the concept of club promotions officers. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, the FAI, the league was struggling. It was managed by the clubs. They were struggling with finances. They were basically falling apart financially. So the FAI took over the league. And as part of, the strategic paper of taking over the league, we wanted the clubs to embed themselves much more in the community. So we looked at different models around Europe, and we settled on the Club Promotion Officer Program. So my first job was to hire and train, I think it was 15 club promotion officers from around the country, and obviously to design the role. So, for example, we didn't want them getting involved in sponsorship or marketing issues. We want them just to focus on creating connections with the community groups. And that's how I met you, actually, is because we were looking to see, okay, it's fine to reach out to the community and build them links and get them to come to the matches. But when they come to the matches, what are they seeing? So, yeah, I mean, we had the club promotion officers calling to lots of schools, calling to lots of local grassroots clubs, building the connection between the professional club and the community group, whatever that was. getting them to come to a match of the first team to see if they liked it, basically, suck it and see. But we found that there was a hole in the bucket. So they would come to the match. But unfortunately, the match experience in Ireland wasn't really good enough at most of our stadiums. So we kind of went, well, what's the point? If they're coming to the match, that's great, but they're not coming back because the experience is not so good. And if you don't mind, I'd like to tell a small story. But when I was a player, I was playing for Shamrock Rovers in Dublin towards the end of my career, and the landlady where I lived wanted to come to a match to see me play because she saw me get ready for training. She knew that football was my life. So she decided she wanted to come to the stadium to see me play. So she came to the match. She paid 15 euros. I don't know why I didn't get her a ticket, actually. She paid 15 euros to get into the match, and she went to use the bathroom, for example, and there was no lights and there was no toilet roll. So she said to me, look, I enjoyed the match actually, but I can't go back there because it's a really difficult experience to go to the game. And something in my head kind of clicked and went, oh, so we're doing all this training, but behind us, you know, the quality of product we're putting out, we want people to see our work and to see us expressing ourselves. But unfortunately, the club that I'm playing for has not actually got any sort of fan experience perspective. Or certainly that team of volunteers at the club was not focused on it, I guess. They just thought this is the way a football match should be. It's concrete. It's just a bad experience, really. It's, yeah, it's hanging out with your mates, I guess, and it's some alcohol. But the experience was only for a very, very narrow group of people, actually. So I realized as a player there was something wrong. And then when I went to the association working on the club promotion officer program, I realized that there was a whole world of fan experience that we weren't looking at. And then I got interested through you, actually. And you were a great mentor for me on this. And the fan experience company worked closely with the FEI to do the fan journey, I guess. You did auditing of the stadiums for us. I remember you doing Datamon Park and others. And we had a report basically written for us, which was really invaluable for the clubs to say, here's the experience of coming to a match. You can't get parking, or you know, the food is not great or is great or whatever it was. And that allowed us then to have a starting point of, here's the deficiencies that we have. Here's where people who come to the matches probably won't come back again. And it allowed us, it was a whole journey which goes on to this day in UEFA across Europe.
Just on that point, what was the, when you had that first report, what was the club's reaction to it? Was there lots of...
Well, it's a very good question, actually. I mean, the clubs were institutionalized, a lot of them. So they kind of felt that's how it should be. So if big clubs in England can get huge crowds with a bad experience, why can't we? Mm-hmm. But they just didn't probably react in the way that we really wanted. They were quite short-term, which is if you win a match, that more people want to come.
Yeah,
And if you lose, they don't come, which we knew very quick, very well, this wasn't the case. So what I would say is that, I mean, if you look at the report that Mark did on Bohemian Football Club, now it's a spectacular experience to go and see Bohemians.
I think what Bohemians have done really well, Noel, that we used to talk about, every club has a really strong identity, but they don't really do much with it. But you can't say that about Bulls. They do so much with their identity, what they stand for. They really kind of, they walk the talk, don't they? And as a consequence, they're attracting people who ordinarily wouldn't be interested in football. It's kind of more of a movement than a football club now, isn't it, down there?
Absolutely. It's like part of a lifestyle almost. I mean, they've Bohemians Football Club, Datamon Park, is in the inner city. And the area has been regenerated, a lot of us. So you've got a lot of hipsters and professional people who want to belong to something. And Bohemians tapped into that. They have got, you know, they're, I don't even want to use the word branding, actually. It's just their DNA is left field. It is not artificial. It is clearly coming from the people who run the club. I mean, Daniel Lambert, who's a wonderful guy who runs the football club from the experience perspective and the, again, I suppose you have to use the brand perspective, but it runs through their DNA. They have used the history of the stadium, which had people like Pele playing there, the national team played there, Bob Marley played concerts there. They've used that wonderfully in their imagery. They've tapped into a psyche in that area of old Dublin, the rebel spirit of Irish people. They've tapped into that really well. And I mean, they don't have a ticket to sell it, I'm told.
It's really significant, Noel, because we're forever in the work we do, telling clubs, make it about you, make it about what's unique about the city or the town or the club that fans can really tap into. Because so many clubs think that you can almost do get a kit out of the box and just start to put in a fan zone or put in some kind of food and it will work, and obviously it doesn't, and it sounds like you completely think the opposite of that, and they have to go for what's unique to them.
I do. I really agree with that, because like there was this phrase came out before many years ago, was fan engagement. And I suppose with Mark, we picked up that there was a huge amount of, the customer journey needed to be mapped, and that all had to be pleasant and nice. But where does that journey come from? From what place does that journey come from? So if I'm going to, for example, Shamrock Rovers in the city of Dublin, it's a very nice experience. Bohemians don't want a nice experience, actually. They want it nice in not the traditional sense of we think of a nice, where you've got car parking. You won't get it there.
Yeah,
you're going to get craft beer. You're going to get a lot of hipsters with beards and big jumpers. You're going to get a difficult stadium, I would say, in terms of it's old and some of it, but it's a lot of graffiti. There's a lot of edginess to it. It's probably grunginess. But that's them. And enough people buy into that DNA, want to be part of that. So it doesn't mean you need to have nice, sanitized car parking spaces with someone polishing the car parking spaces, etc.
Yeah.
It means there has to be an authentic, real experience. So a very simple example for me, I grew up in North London, and I'm an Arsenal fan, and I used to love going to the old Highbury. It was quite unique because it was in amongst all these houses. Mm-hmm. You couldn't call it a lovely experience, but it was unique. It was the history of that part of London, the history of the old stadium. When they moved to the Emirates, it lost part of me because it was too nice, actually, the experience was. But it didn't capture my Arsenal.
Yeah.
So I lost a bit of my Arsenal when they moved to the Emirates. Whereas Bohemians now, it's not what we would call a sanitized nice experience, but it's a bloody lovely experience if you're like that edgy, hipster, indie type lifestyle. Yeah.
Kind of a little bit like their own version. I mean, completely different, but a bit like San Pauli, in Hamburg.
Yeah, it does. I suppose there's a bit of a suspicion, Mark, that the San Pauli experience is a little bit manufactured because there's agencies behind it and that kind of stuff. But if I was to take what I knew of San Pauli, I would agree that they were absolutely at the front. I mean, also Celtic, for example, their home matches are quite unique as well. Are they nice experiences? I'm not sure I'd call them nice, but somebody seems to have mapped a journey. And the same, by the way, to be clear on that, like lots of clubs have their own unique experiences. I went to a Rangers match, for example, a couple of years ago, a European match, and that was a really good experience. I wouldn't say it was a nice experience, but it was a really good experience for me to see it and to see how the journey, the rituals, the traditions, the authenticity of going to a Rangers match was really clear to me. And I understood if I was from that culture and from that background, why I would be attracted to going. Yeah.
So speaking of European matches, you're now at UEFA. I think if I've got it right, head of business development for associations. And the thing I believe you're most proud of is creating the GROW programme. Mm. So can you tell us a little bit about that and also about your experiences of actually, being brought up in with English and Irish football and then finding yourself dealing with 55 associations, probably the most diverse group of people in the world. How have you managed to I wouldn't say stamp, but take your experience of what you learned in Ireland and in England and share it with the 55 associations that you have at UEFA?
Well, UEFA brought me in from the FEI because they wanted to support the federations on, to be honest, the start was marketing commercial type issues. So I was helping the federations to, build their sponsorship portfolios and bring in partners and all that kind of stuff. But very quickly, I suppose, they realized that this was much broader, that this was we didn't have a development program for European football. So we looked at the issues that were facing European football. One was the image of the game. We'd had the recent issues of Blatter and FIFA and all that stuff, mm-hmm. and Platini as well as in the media. So we had issues with the image of football. So that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. We had decreasing participation. We had the sport. So participation was the second one. Yeah. Engagement, we'll call it, which was online and offline, I suppose, which we believe was changing. There was a huge evolution in that. And we didn't believe that our football federations were responding to it in the way they should. So a simple example being that the clubs that you worked with in the Football League, for example, were getting this wonderful service from you on how to evolve their service, to improve and that kind of stuff. But we were visiting stadiums all over Europe, which were just concrete masses with nothing. And we could see attendances decrease across Europe, as well as participation. From the digital perspective, for example, if you played for Spain back then when we started, you were world champions and European champions. So if you take Gerard Piqué, for example, he was playing for Barcelona with, 50 or 60 people in the Barcelona engagement department, and in Spain there was nobody. So he was going from chalk from day to night. The federation weren't accepting that these were global brands that they were. So Spain, as I say, were world champions and European Euro champions. So they'd got the full sweep, but they weren't responding to that as a service provider to their fans, I guess. So we were trying to... And then the last thing, by the way, was revenues, which we felt the federations could drive more revenue from this as well. But they were all interreliant on each other. So if the image of the federation was bad, that would damage the amount of partners that wanted to be with you, the amount of fans that wanted to come to the stadium, the amount of people that wanted to play soccer in that country. So that was the start of it. We built this program where each federation, we presented image research to what people felt about them. We presented their numbers in terms of engagement, attendances, all that kind of stuff, the amount of people playing soccer in the country. And then we showed them where they could be. And what happened from that was interesting because there was a load of other things they wanted, which was, for example, stuff we're working on now, which is fan experience in some of the countries. In Estonia, as you well know, and in other countries, we're working on the whole fan experience of league attendances. We built essentially a complete suite of products for federation, for football federations, a menu of items they could take from to help their own specific issues. I suppose being Irish, we got on relatively well with people from across Europe, like yourself from the north of England. So we would be quite good at facilitating discussions, but we never pretended that we knew the answers. We just wanted to present what we had seen at our football clubs. We wanted to understand what their issues were. Some of them were quite different. I mean, for example, in Eastern Europe, if you take a fan experience, it's up until certainly recently, maybe still, it still has a very security conscious. So you still have police, very visible, the army in some circumstances. It's not nice to go to matches in some parts of Eastern Europe still. So your work, Mark, and experience company has a long way to go. There's countries that need to radically change how they engage with people so that we can continue to grow the numbers of people that want to come to football matches. So we've a long way to go, but I think all of our minds have evolved. We know by and large what's required. It's just the scale of this thing. There's 55 countries in UEFA.
I guess the biggest thing now is that one size just can't fit all in that situation. So every single association must have its own completely unique set of challenges and objectives that you have to. So almost as you go from one to the other, you're almost finding a completely new set of things to look at.
Every country is very, very different. I mean, if you take Estonia's relationship with football, very, very different to the Spanish relationship with football, where it's everywhere. In Estonia, it's competing with its history, where it was seen possibly as a sport from Russia, for example, or from the Soviet Union. It has a different connotation in Estonia, for example. So you're trying to build something from a low base upwards, whereas in other countries, you have countries like Croatia, where football is everywhere, but it competes with various political issues that are going on.
Funny you should mention Croatia, because Ante Čivarić from the marketing team there is going to be one of our guests and talk a little bit specifically about that. Darren, you had another question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that because all those associations have got those different challenges, and I know that I've sort of asked it already about the buy-in from clubs in Ireland, but getting the buy-in at a national association level must be incredibly difficult now.
Yeah, it can be quite political. It can be quite diplomacy required and all that stuff. I suppose the reason I do the role, and everyone in my team, you know, is selected on the basis that they can deliver sometimes messages that might not be the most popular, but that they're accepted because we've got authenticity ourselves and we're football fans. We also have the skill set of how to build audiences and how to build products. Therefore, we have, I hope, the credibility in all of the federations to explain why they need to change what they need to change, and to be accepted as somebody who's saying it from a non-political perspective, that we just want to see our beautiful sport grow. And here are the barriers to the game growing. Therefore, yeah, we ask you to work with us. UEFA does have a very strong credibility as well, of course.
And I guess everyone at the end of the day is just trying to help everyone. You know, we're all,
yeah,
we're not really, you know, I always think we're not competing for these fans. Actually, you know, people are in whatever country they're in will support the national team, whatever club they support, they will go there. Everyone can actually help everyone to have a better experience.
They can. An important point I'd make to you is, though, why the GROW programme and UEFA's intervention is important, because if the fan experience company, for example, goes to a federation, explains that you should do X, Y, and Z with fans, the federations can look upon you as an agency, if you want to call it that.
Right.
You know, it's in your interest to say that. It's in no interest to us to say that. What? Now, I know you're all massive football fans, so you do things for the right reasons. At UEFA, we could have 20 different areas we could focus on the federation. We don't get anything. We pay ourselves to support them. So we use UEFA budgets to support them. So we've nothing to gain from it, yeah, except pure altruistic wanting to help them. So we will introduce, for example, yourselves, if it's a fan experience matter, because we trust you. We know that you're very good people and that you want to do it for the right reasons. If we see a partner that are not doing it for the right reasons, we pick up on that very, very quickly, and so do the federation. And if they're starting to try and do something because it's in their interests, it doesn't work for us in the UEFA GO program. It has to be win-win-win for everybody. We know, I mean, Mark is the first person in fan experience that I really came across and spoke my language.
I think one of the nice things for me is when you and I go back to creating that growing the club booklet that I think was done in 2008, which had just a lot of really achievable, realistic, genuine ways that clubs of different sizes could attract people, could engage them in, you know, as you say, to plug the hole in the bottom of the bucket. What's nice now is the same thing's happening. There's ideas coming from different countries. And what's more, a country like Estonia, that's at the very beginning of its journey, by definition has a clean slate. And they're coming up with ideas that we're thinking are perfect for everywhere else, perhaps for women's football in Denmark, perhaps for lower league football in the UK. You know, that's one of the big pleasures of, you know, of working in your way, from working with you and the team, is that you see ideas in one country and you just see their potential somewhere else. And obviously what happens is you get a virtuous circle that continues to spin.
Yes. Well, that's the nice thing about federations is, you know, they're not competing, because if I'm from Spain, I'm going to follow Spain. Whereas clubs sometimes are competing a little bit, I suppose, in their various countries. Our federations, we had a previous program called KISS. It wasn't Keep It Simple Stupid. It was Knowledge Information Sharing Scenario, which predated GROW, which was basically sharing best practices. So what UEFA was very good at was bringing federations together to discuss challenges and that. But we realized discussing them wasn't enough. We had to have action. So I obviously had a background in the League of Ireland. There's not a lot of money. It's not like the English Premier League or the Football League, for that matter. There's very little money around. So when you created, Mark, with us, the Grow Your Club Guide, it needed to be extremely practical, and it needed to succinctly communicate messages that were not too abstract for people who wouldn't have time to read a thesis on something. it needed to be extremely practical, and owners could pick it up and buy into it immediately, which they did. And that was crucial, that, you know, that you could give the message clearly, simply, but they could get quick wins as well. Because once you get their trust with quick wins, then you can develop something much deeper with them. And I must say that the European federations and leagues, the terrain is ripe to continue to go. There's so many more projects we want to work on. It's actually a budgetary issue. And I suppose that in the period that we're discussing this, where we're in the midst of the pandemic, I suppose one of the slight concerns for me is that our budgets won't allow us to do all of the projects that we want to do. Because naturally, like any business, UEFA will be hit by this lack of football matches, which, you know, there's lack of revenue. So we need to adjust. However, we believe 100% in what we're doing. The work we're doing on fan experience is gold, and we'll continue promoting that across Europe.
It was one of the questions I was going to ask, you know, just to sort of to wrap things up, and that was, where does the Grow programme go in the future, given you know, obviously the budgetary potential constraints going forward, but where do you see the programme going?
Well, about 2 years ago, we had this idea that Grow helps federations to improve where they are now, but we needed to create a vision for the future. So we came with a concept, a vision for UEFA Grow, called Football Federations of the Future, which was basically taking each of the pillars, whether it's participation or engagement or revenues or brands or whatever it is, and we basically brought together all of our best people from the federations, from our clubs that play in European competition, in the Champions League and Europa League, our sponsors who are big partners of UEFA, broadcasters, etc., people from federations from as far as distant as Japan to Canada. We brought them together over a six-month period to write the future of what a football federation should look like. And we created a document called Football Federations of the Future, which effectively in each pillar says what we want the federation to be, where the federation could be by 2024. We had three different levels, which was England naturally would be an A, or should be an A, in most of these areas. Whereas if you're Gibraltar or you're Liechtenstein, it's much more difficult to get to A in some of these areas. Because, for example, if you take insights and research, understanding the fans' behaviour, their feelings, their wants, it's very hard for Gibraltar to justify having a department or a full-time person working on consumer research, for example, or focus groups. Whereas England would have 8 or 9 people, I think, in the research and insights division. So we wanted the federations to become more data-driven, more insights research-driven, for example, better at how they deliver the product, if you want to call it, to fans, so better at fan experience. So we basically created the Football Federation of the Future. So our job over the next number of years is to get each federation to do a self-analysis of where they are under each of the pillars. We're doing it at the moment with Belgium, Scotland, Northern Ireland, a few more, where they look at themselves under each pillar, assess where they are. We challenge each other, so UEFA challenges the federation, and then we write the vision of the future for each federation, and we hope by 2024, each of the federations is on the level they want to be. So basically, a roadmap for each federation, and then support them to achieve that.
And now it's
time for the roundup.
Looking at the roundup for this podcast, the theme appears to be activities over Twitter. And we've got Peterborough 1934. That's the Twitter account for the famous rabbit, who is Peterborough United's mascot. And he's been doing a lot of exercises and other mischief for the younger followers of the posh. Closer to home, Luke O'Neill from my beloved Sunderland, who I might add 47 years ago today were winning the FA Cup. He does a weekly workout. And so far, and I think in a period of about 3 weeks, him and his followers have managed to raise more than £7,000 for NHS and carer charities. And it got us thinking about the things that people can do with mascots when they put them online. We remember Darren and I talking to Willem Twee. They had a very popular mascot, Kingo, who would appear at the game, greet kids, entertain them. And then Willem Twee got to the Dutch FA Cup final. And what then happened was transformational. Kingo went and opened an Instagram account. And within days, his timeline was filled with messages from kids wishing the team good luck in the final. One day, we'll all get to the level that Lucille is at the Giants, of course, in San Francisco. But I think the idea of taking your mascot and making him digital is something that now during the pandemic and in the future is going to be more and more and more popular.
We've seen clubs start to do it, haven't we, Mark, in the EFL especially. You know, there's a steady increase in clubs who are understanding that the mascot can play a massive role, not just on match days, but also in the build-up to games. And there's so much sense in the club doing that on the mascot's own digital channels, because obviously it means they can focus all their family and messages and content that's aimed at families and younger fans in one place. So it makes sense for everyone.
It does. Well, thanks for that, Darren. And a big thank you, Noel. It's been brilliant having you on today's podcast. And thanks for your time today. Well,
thank you, Noel. It's fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
And we'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you soon.
And don't forget to check out our new website at fanexperienceco.com. The Fan Experience was recorded live. See you next time.